welcome to Cairo Nights, where our motto, you know, actually we don't have a motto. We need to come up with a motto. I've been thinking about trying to come up with a motto. Shane, do you have a motto for the show?
No. You got to give me some more time, Mike. I think I could probably come up with something.
All right,
now.
Frank. Well, you guys are both on task for coming up with a motto.
I have a motto. Kind
of, what's this?
We're here.
No. Not taking that one.
Okay. Fine.
We need a motto, not a declaration. All right. So Frank is obviously here, news boss. Shane Peterson is here, chairman of the board. I am Mike Lewis. We are, I'm particularly pleased with this show for a few reasons. One, we have a chance to talk to Andrew McIntosh about the sort of an omnibus Boeing segment. We are going to talk about the Cathay Pacific order. Not necessarily cancellation, but order. They're putting off the big order for the 777X. That's a big deal. But there's a lot of stuff going on there regarding the certification of the 737. We're going to talk about all of it coming up at 8 o'clock. We're going to be talking an extended period with Stacey Joros, who brought in a very interesting story about how her radio show ended up on this list of top radio shows, sports radio shows in the country. But There is a lack of something on that list that caught her very, very off guard. We're also going to talk about, well, the big news of the day. We've got stuff about OxyContin, a big government settlement there. We're going to talk about the Pope. We're going to talk about the fact that in some places, it appears that going back to school is safer, maybe, than staying out of school. At least that's what some of the scientific data appears to be showing. And, of course, it wouldn't be a show without something regarding bovine flatulence, and we'll be getting to that in just a little bit. First, this is the big fish in terms of government settlements this year, actually over the last few years. The Department of Justice came to a settlement with Purdue Pharma. If you're not familiar with Purdue Pharma, it is the company that led the way in populating the country with OxyContin. They have been held not entirely, not criminally liable. This is a civil penalty. It is a settlement of more than $8 billion. The company will plead guilty to three counts, including conspiracy to defraud the United States and violating federal anti-kickback laws. The resolution will be detailed in a bankruptcy court filing in federal court. U.S. Attorney Jeff Rosen.
The Department of Justice is announcing a global resolution of our criminal and civil investigations into the opioid manufacturer Purdue Pharma, as well as a civil resolution with members of the Sackler family who comprise shareholders of the company.
CBS News correspondent Jim Krasula has some more details.
Purdue Pharma has pleaded guilty to federal charges over its production and sales of the prescription opioid painkiller OxyContin. Deputy Attorney General Jeff Rosen.
The global settlement announced today involves the company pleading guilty to three felony counts for defrauding the United States.
Purdue has agreed to pay more than $8 billion in fines and damages. It's believed the nation's opioid addiction and overdose crisis has claimed nearly a half million lives over the past 20 years. Jim Krasula, CBS News.
So, I don't know about you, but I feel like Purdue is getting off pretty easy in this regard. One, the company pleading guilty to felonies are not like you and I pleading guilty to felonies. No one is going to jail over this, which is shocking, and I think a complete abdication of our responsibility as a society of what we should be doing here. There's been very few things in the country. Coronavirus occurred outside the boundaries, at least that's depending on what conspiracy theory you subscribe to, outside the boundaries of a corporation. Purdue Pharma, which donated heavily to medical schools all over the country, heavily to politics, was a load-bearing pillar in what turned into an opioid problem in the United States that killed 500,000 people. So I guess if you want to do a per person cost with Purdue, maybe it's a bad line item in their budget. But the fact is that these folks conspired. They knew, one, it was addictive when they were telling doctors it wasn't. That's all in the court documents. Two, they lied about its addictive nature to virtually everyone, including the people who were taking it. Three, they were paying doctors to prescribe it when doctors did not need to prescribe it. The issue goes on and on, and then they dug in and fought every time a lawsuit was brought. The nice thing about this federal settlement, a little more on that. The nice thing about this federal settlement is one, it does not preclude criminal charges, which absolutely should be pursued. Two, it does not preclude criminal charges against individual members of the Sackler family, owners of Purdue Pharmaceutical. And if you're worried about the Sackler family, they've socked away billions of dollars on those 500,000 deaths in the United States. Three, this does not preclude the state attorneys general, of which Washington is involved, in their own individual lawsuits against Purdue Pharmaceutical. I think a couple of states have settled out for $223 million, I think, last year. But Washington is still in the game. Most of the states who understand the gravity of this situation are still in the game. And this is a fundamentally important litigation, not just because it takes Purdue Pharmaceutical off the backs of a whole bunch of people in the United States, both those who passed away and those who remain addicted and those who are recovering from addiction, but it also does this. It sets a precedent for future pharmaceutical companies who do this sort of dirty work nationally. This was the company that pursued the idea of pain as the fifth vital sign. So in other words, that doctors should be asking you, giving you that on a 1 to 10 scale, how much pain are you feeling? And then over whatever number you said, they were then prescribing opioids. I'm not suggesting that opioids shouldn't be prescribed. For some patients, for cancer patients, for people with extraordinary pain, absolutely. In limited doses with regular recurring prescriptions so someone can't sock it away. That is not what happened with the opioid crisis in the United States. And if you're wondering about when you're walking around and you're seeing people who are nodding off or dying from fentanyl and heroin, many of them started on these pills. That's not even in question anymore. So the problems that the Sacklers are trying to settle out of at this particular juncture are things we are dealing with today. Every time you walk outside in Seattle, every time you walk outside in Tacoma, if you walk outside in Everett, you see the evidence of what the crop that Purdue Pharmaceutical planted across the United States, in addition to, Purdue's cohorts, the other companies manufacturing this, the pharmacies that were distributing it. This is a bigger problem than just Purdue, but it's nice to see at least someone feel a minor amount of pain in this. What I'd like to do is for have them to feel unmedicated, a lot more pain. And I would like to see some criminal charges brought. Well, we'll see. So the companies have agreed to pay an additional $25 million in civil penalties. Prosecutors said the agreement, of course, did not preclude the filing of criminal charges. The federal settlement also doesn't end all of the rest of the litigation. The state's litigation can go ahead. The other litigation can go ahead. It doesn't actually create some sort of blanket immunity against future. The downside is that the feds could have pushed much harder than the feds did, but it did give the Department of Justice a win for the Trump administration, and that's what the Trump administration was definitely hoping for. This is a sizable settlement. $8 billion isn't chump change, although it's probably not going to end up as that much money because the company is already in bankruptcy protection. So essentially the federal government has to line up along with the other creditors and wait for this money, whatever money is left, to be paid out. And most of the Sackler family over the last few years, in fact, this was documented in a New York Times story, began moving money into protected accounts and overseas and other places so they could protect their wealth while making sure that they didn't have to pay an abundance of money, given it was only 500,000 people dead. I mean, why should they have to pay that much for that? OxyContin came into the market, if you remember it. And I remember getting a 30 pill prescription for like a sprained ankle at one particular point. It came out of the market in the mid 1990s and it was seen as this kind of like semi miracle drug. It was touted as a non-addictive pain reliever and a really strong one at that, and it worked amazingly well. The lie was the non-addictive part. The truth was it did work really well, but it was highly, highly addictive. And so people found that once they went through a prescription, they were needing more, and doctors were willing to prescribe it because they were also getting kickbacks from the manufacturers. It made the Sackler family one of the wealthiest families in America on the back of the people who were addicted and on the manufacturing of this particular pill. So we'll see where this ends up going, but I am glad that the federal government at least extracted something from a company that's extracted so much from the United States. This story, I think, is pretty interesting, and there's no doubt that it's going to be as controversial as every other thing that Pope Francis does. In a new documentary, Pope Francis said, he does not oppose, you know, outside of the Catholic Church, he does not oppose civil unions for same-sex couples. This is from CBS News correspondent Elaine Cobb.
In an unusually clear expression of support for same-sex couples, Pope Francis has endorsed civil union laws. In a new documentary, Francesco, he says homosexual couples have a right to be legally protected. It's his clearest language yet on something the Catholic Church is still officially against. But this Pope is seen as more progressive than his predecessors.
I'm convinced that we can make a difference.
Pope Francis also said no one should be thrown out of the church because they're gay. Elaine Cobb, CBS News.
So he became the first pope to endorse, it's sort of a light endorsement, endorse same-sex civil unions in the comment. The documentary is called Francesco, and it is it's an Italian documentary, and I don't see where we can find it, but I'll follow up with that later in the show and let you know, if you are interested in watching it, where you can find this documentary. I imagine if you search it online, you'll find it pretty quickly. Quote, he said, homosexuals have the right to be in a family. They are children of God, Francis said in one of the sit-down interviews for the film. Quote, you can't kick someone out of a family nor make their life miserable for this. We have to have a civil union so they are legally covered. Fordham University theology professor Patrick Hornbeck says it's important to note that despite his comments, church doctrine remains the same.
This seems to be a man who loves his gay friends, who knows and embraces trans people and queer people. But he's also the head of a church that for many, many years, and at great political cost to itself, has affirmed that every sexual act has to be open to procreation. And by definition, that rules out most LGBT people.
So the remarks came at kind of a pivotal time. This is according to Vox in the United States, where the Senate is expected to confirm Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. Her confirmation would give conservatives on the court a 6-3 majority and potentially the votes to overturn prior rulings from marriage equality to employment discrimination against LGBTQ Americans. She would also be one of 6 Catholics on the court. We'll see whether or not the Pope's lead has any bearing on the way they see things. I think that the same-sex marriage thing, I'm guessing, there is nothing pending in the U.S. Supreme Court that could undermine where we're at right now. But what he's also said, and he's been kind of consistent in this, is that he sees the church having absolute rules. The church is in no way in favor of gay marriage. But he also sees that society as a whole can have a set of rules that allow people to live and just establish legal rights. For example, in civil union, you know, the right to visit your sick partner in the hospital, inheritance, those sort of things that are not necessarily afforded by default in the law are afforded if you have a civil union. And that's what a lot of people have argued. So he would argue, the Pope has essentially said over the course of his time as Pope, that the church can operate under a specific set of rules as it sees from a church doctrine, a moral and ethical world, and then that the rest of the world can operate and have this not be in dramatic conflict. He actually sees a distinction between, well, of course, you know, the church still has its doctrine, and it's been teaching this doctrine for a long time, and it's modified it over time. That does not mean that folks who are operating within a society with a set of legal guidelines can't actually establish themselves in those legal guidelines and not be, you know, and not require the church to change. The church isn't the government, not require the church to change its doctrine on things. So this obviously has led to a lot of conservatives within the church getting pretty unhappy because they feel like it's backsliding on what church doctrine is. The liberals in the church feel like that's not necessarily the case, but the conservative critics within the church, this is according to the New York Times, they have for years accused them of diluting church doctrine, and they saw the remarks as a reversal of church teaching. The Pope's statement, this is from Bishop Thomas Tobin of Providence, Rhode Island. The Pope's statement clearly contradicts what has been the longstanding teaching of the church about same-sex unions. That was a fairly consistent point, among church conservatives. On the other end of the Jesuit priest, Reverend Antonio Spadaro, and he's a close friend of Francis. He said the remark, quote, in no way affects doctrine. So you're finding that you're two opposite views on this. But I think it's interesting moving ahead. I think this is one of the things that Francis has been pretty consistent on about trying to ratchet down hostility toward people who believe something different and finding a way to create a society where even if your religious doctrines are not being met by other people, that is no reason to believe that you can't actually function together in a kind manner in one society. Here is a story that is going to get a lot of people in Washington, I'm sure, worked up. You may not have seen this today. It was on NPR, but I didn't see it widely distributed elsewhere. And this is interesting. I'll read you the top of it. Despite widespread concerns, two new international studies show no consistent relationship between in-person K-12 schooling and the spread of coronavirus. A third study from the United States shows no elevated risk to childcare workers who stayed on the job. Combined with anecdotal reports of the number of U.S. states where schools are open, as well as crowdsourced dashboards of around 2,000 U.S. schools, some medical experts are beginning to say it's time to shift to the discussion from the risks of opening K-12 schools to the risks of actually keeping them closed. As a pediatrician, I am starting to see, this is Dr. Danielle Dooley. She's a medical director of Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C. She told this to NPR. As a pediatrician, I'm really seeing the negative impacts of these school closures on children. And she goes on to talk about how that maybe we are not focused in the right direction on school closures. This does mirror, if you remember on the show, we talked about how in Florida, two things seem to happen simultaneously. One, they had this huge spike in coronavirus when the state decided to open up, but it was largely between 20 somethings and 30 somethings, and a lot of it was associated with college and parties and get togethers and hanging out on the beach and things like that. That's at least what some of the tracing showed. It did not actually spike when they opened up schools. And so, can we find a place that somehow between the opening of society largely and opening up of schools, the people who've been advocating about this and pretty angry with the governor, it looks like that they may have a point. Now, one caveat, some of these studies were done in places that have very, very tight restrictions elsewhere in society. And so schools are a part of those restrictions. We will see. But it does look like there is some compelling evidence that maybe we're getting close to the point where we should be thinking about opening up. Now, this is K-12 schools. None of the studies applied to college. We didn't get time to get to NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft, which touched on an asteroid today. I'm going to try and squeeze it in somewhere because it's maybe my favorite story of the day. But coming up, we're going to be talking with Rachel Bell, as we always do at this particular hour, right after the break.
You can ring my bell, Rachel Bell. welcome back to this kind of night.
Rachel is making sound effects. What was the sound effect for, Rachel?
That was my spraying disinfectant sound effect.
People tend to do that. Every room I've been in, they seem to disinfect right after I leave it. I'm not trying not to take it personally.
Yeah, I'm spraying it right in your face.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that, Rachel. Hey, so this was, you and I were sort of yapping about this in the newsroom a while ago. This idea that during, we've seen the burn through on the restaurant and bar industry as a result of coronavirus, how many places have closed. And I am sort of shocked at this idea that you did a story on the fact that there are places that are opening during the pandemic, right?
Right. Every couple of weeks, I'll get an email about a new restaurant opening in Seattle. And I wonder, why would you ever start a new business in the middle of a pandemic?
I signed the lease October 11th.
We started our build out February 17th. Just about a month later, the COVID shutdown happened. And by then, it's too late.
A lot of people, they've sunk hundreds of thousands of dollars into a space. They don't have the option to not do this.
So I signed my lease back in March of last year.
Victor Steinbrook signed the lease for his very first restaurant, Fremont's Local Tide, back in March of 2019. But because of COVID delays, he didn't open until this August.
Extremely daunting. I had numerous conversations with consultants and other people in the industry that advised me, you know, don't open, and even to possibly pull out depending on how much money was put in. Obviously not an option for me. Too much had gone into it at this point. And I wouldn't think about doing that anyways. We all understood what we were getting into, and we were ready for what came.
What came was shifting to takeout and a redesigned menu, because his original seafood concept wasn't going to hold up to takeout containers that could sit in a car for up to a half hour. But unfortunately, some clueless customers aren't giving restaurants a break. Front of house manager Nanette Jackson says people can be unnecessarily harsh on Yelp.
For things that are just so minute and unbelievable. So the crab roll. You can only order the crab roll when you come. You have to stand in line. People stand out here for an hour. So even if you call me at 12 and you say, hey, can I order a crab roll? I'm going to say no, because these people have been standing here, and that's respectful. This one guy left a 2-star review because he said the lady on the phone wouldn't let me order a crab roll. In a world where we live based off of ratings and social media, you don't understand the impact of when you do that.
Aaron T. Colvey is another new restaurant owner. He was set to open Sorrel in Seattle's Madison Valley just 4 days after the shutdown happened. When he eventually opened in July for takeout and limited seating, he could no longer afford a staff.
The truth is, it's just me. My wife has pitched in and is working front of house, but this isn't necessarily her profession. She works in childcare. I wear every single hat in the business right now.
He has created a super safe environment on the covered patio behind the restaurant.
We are only seating 2 tables at a night, and there are only up to 5 guests, and each table gets its own bathroom. We're actually never coming to the table. We use a landing table where we drop the dishes. It keeps us at least 6 feet away from the table.
Martha Fletcher has owned the Blarney Stone Pub near Pike Place Market since 2006. She had signed a lease for a new place in Queen Anne, anticipating the crowds from Kraken hockey fans. But because of COVID delays, she hopes to open Caird Public House in mid-November. If you would have seen this coming, would you not have opened a second location?
You know, I've thought about that a million times. I mean, there's obviously one side of me that says, oh, no, I wouldn't do it. But before I bought the Blarney Stone, I tried doing other things, you know, getting quote unquote a real job. But I just loved this business, even though it's so hard sometimes. I wouldn't trade it for the world, even now, which is people think I'm crazy, but I'm just trying to be positive and stay afloat until we can move on with life and get going again. You know, I might have pulled out. But luckily, I didn't have the choice.
Knowing what you know now, would you have opened a new space?
Oh, man, that is hard. I'm going to say maybe, because I think actually I had better opportunity here with this space to survive this moment, especially with the complete failure that unemployment has been and continues to be. I don't have any faith that as an independent contractor, I would have gotten help.
While others are struggling to stay afloat, Theo Dye has opened 2 new bubble tea shops during the pandemic. He signed his second lease in Kirkland in August and opened DIY Tea Lab just a few weeks later. So why did you decide to open a second location in the middle of all this?
The impact is not so bad for the bubble tea shop, but I'm also thinking maybe this is also an opportunity, because when a lot of places they close, meaning you can easily maybe get a cheaper rent or get a better lease.
Unlike a sit-down restaurant, most people take bubble tea to go anyway. And now Theo is looking to open a third location. Luckily, all of these owners have had forgiving landlords who gave them breaks on their rent when it was impossible to open early on in the pandemic.
That is encouraging, to say the least. I love to hear things like that. And one of the things that I think we've learned in business is that sometimes when doors close in front of you, it does open up other doors. And that's exactly what the bubble tea guy said, right?
Yeah. And it's interesting for the other two restaurants, Sorrel and Local Tide. These are their first restaurants, so they don't know any difference.
Right.
This is how they're starting. And so going forward, when things get better, it's going to feel amazing because nothing could ever be as hard as this is. But I feel bad for them because, especially for Local Tide, they changed their whole menu so it could be to go. And it's not the food that he wanted to put out there. You know, he's been cooking and having a pop-up for years, and he had all these plans, and he had to shift to mostly sandwiches and salads because you can't send a piece of like a whole fish that you've roasted in the car for half an hour. It's going to be cold and soggy.
Right. And I actually, you raise an excellent point that learning to, it's sort of like, I don't know, I heard this once compared to Olympic skiers, the ones who grew up with the worst snow and the lousiest conditions, like in New Hampshire and places, blue ice, ended up as great skiers because they learned when it was difficult.
Yeah.
And they when they got it in a good situation, they were phenomenal. And that's what these businesses are kind of set up for. I mean, they're learning it at the worst possible time to be in business in Seattle. And so when things turn around for them, and I certainly hope they do, they're going to be pretty well positioned.
Right. And going back to the Yelp reviews, be nice out there. We kind of talked about this a few months ago. You know, first of all, be a good orderer. Do not get French fries if you're going to take them to go and not eat them for a half an hour. They're going to be cold and Right. They're going to be hard. Like, you got to know better. I hope that restaurants are doing what they're doing and, you know, changing the menu if they are doing a lot of to-go, because they shouldn't send things home that aren't going to last. But, you know, if you have a legit complaint, call the restaurant, email them. Don't mess it up on Yelp, because as you know, you don't have a choice. You have to be on Yelp. You can't opt out.
Nope.
And there's all these tricky little things that they do where they're calling you and they're trying to get you to pay more money so that you could have, you know, a better, what do they call it?
The algorithm. And also they are sort of quasi offer to kind of sublimate the bad reviews in some manner. I mean, it's essentially you're paying protection.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a lousy thing.
Yeah, so if you're going to go out, be nice, man. Just be nice, because these people are really trying to figure it out. And like you heard from Aaron, he's the only person working there. So, you know, if you go and you're like, oh, man, this is bad service, then just don't go. I mean, you know, spend your money or don't, and just be nice.
I completely agree. It's nice to see. And the funny thing is, for every one person who's a jerk like that, the two-star guy, there also are people who are amazingly patient and really encouraging when they see that you're trying to stay open. They see that, and they know that it's a struggle. And so those people keep going in, keep coming in. And the rest of you, just a little bit of patience, I think, would do all of us a bit of good.
As Guns N' Roses once sang, just a little patience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you. That was not singing. That was speaking in an annoying voice, and I'm sorry for that.
Coming up at the top of the hour, we're going into a deep dive with Andrew McIntosh, Puget Sound Business Journal. We're going to talk about Boeing. Big news with Cathay Pacific, one of Boeing's big customers for the 777X, and also just general Boeing news about the 737. It's going to be the Boeing Omnibus episode right at the top of the hour.
No need to ask, he's a smooth operator.
So the Seattle Times did a pretty fun story today, an assemblage, if you will, by Amy Wong and Marina Resto on the headline of the story is hockey games, ER visits and more. Readers share the most memorable dates they've been on. And there are some doozies. So let's go with a good one. This is from Joyce. She said, my tires were so bad, I could see the wires coming through the rubber. So I took my car to a local 76 service station, and a nice gentleman repaired the tires for, I guess, replaced the tires for her. When I started backing out, he mumbled something. I didn't understand it, so he repeated, would you like to go to a hockey game with me? She said he was so handsome, I'd never been to a hockey game before. So I said, okay. He was funny and great to be with. He later told me it took him so much nerve to ask me out, and then he had to repeat it twice. And on top of that, he actually hated hockey. He just wanted to go out. The bad ones. Here's a good bad one. I no longer remember this guy's name, which doesn't actually a lot of, I'm sure, bad date stories start with this line. How I met him or why I agreed to go out with him. He took me to dinner at a really nice restaurant in downtown Seattle. I was 20 years old, I think. He was a few years older. I hadn't yet started at the University of Washington. About halfway through dinner, he told me I had, quote, real nice table manners for someone with no higher education. And she said, in my dreams, I flipped my dinner plate onto his lap. In reality, I probably refrained from calling him an idiot, said thank you, finished dinner, went home, and never went out with him again. I'm not sure my table manners improved any when I got my degree. Another bad one. My friends and I were on a double date. Her date was kind of a new boyfriend, and mine was his friend, who seemed nice enough. We were at the Black Angus Steakhouse on Aurora and just ordered our meals. I looked over at this guy, and he had turned an odd greenish hue and was sweating profusely. By then, all of us were looking at him and said weakly, he goes, my foot was run over by a truck this morning. And I said, well, why did you come out to dinner? But since I was 17 and polite at the time, I said, poor thing, now what should we do? Well, we left the restaurant and ended up spending the next couple of hours at UW Medical Center emergency room. Fun date. Never did see him again. It's funny, though. I mean, if you've ever been in that situation when you really, really, really didn't want to miss a date. I was trying so hard to get to a date when I was in college on my bicycle. I was cutting through a park and didn't see what had been some new sidewalk construction there. Hit it full speed and ended up breaking a collarbone, got a concussion on my bicycle, destroyed the front end of my bicycle. Just to get fast on a date. And I could have just called and said, you know, I'm going to be a little bit late. Ended up not ever seeing that person again. Actually, I was in the hospital for a day or two as a result of that. But I particularly like this story because there's also just as many really nice ones. For example, went on a hike near Leavenworth to check out the fall colors, ending up filling our lunch containers with blueberries that we found once we made it to the lake. I sent her home with all the blueberries and she made pancakes with them. Now that is a pretty nice story to have on a date. If you guys want to send me along any quick bad date or good date stories, feel free to do it. 98973. This is and let me get back to one thing. Well, I've got just a minute or two left from earlier in the show. I am a big fan, as I said before on the show, of the space program. I grew up really desperately wanting to be an astronaut. Unfortunately, my eyes were, even as a kid, bad enough that there was no possible way. The only route when I was a kid to becoming an astronaut was to go through pilot training, usually Navy pilot training. That wasn't available to anyone who had less than perfect, uncorrected vision. So, but I still follow it pretty closely. If you aren't aware of this, NASA managed to land a spacecraft, touch the surface of an asteroid on Tuesday to gather a sample of rocks and dirt. The operation proceeded smoothly. The mission operators 200, so it was 200 million miles away, where we managed to do this. I mean, this is hitting a bullseye on a dartboard in the dark, blindfolded at 100 yards. That's how that, I mean, statistically, it may even be much more complicated than that. There's actual some videos right now on the web about the sampling mechanism. So it hit the surface kind of hard, grabbed a bunch of dirt. And then I think immediately the sampling mechanism set down partly on a rock 8 inches wide. It could have caused a problem, but apparently it didn't. And they said, literally, we crushed it. So the folks at NASA have been celebrating it. I love this story. And in fact, was communicating with someone whose brother worked on this very project. Coming up at the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to be talking to Andrew McIntosh, Puget Sound Business Journal, Boeing reporter. He got a pretty good scoop on some orders that are being delayed for the 777, but also some other news on how Boeing is going to fare over the next few months. Stay tuned right after the break.